Welcome to Architecture Talk Tongue. I am Sarah Colara, an architect and organizer of the Disrupt Symposium, the first of its kind business of architecture event, bringing to stage major architecture practices to cover topics related to entrepreneurship and practice operations within the AEC industry. I am an architecture business development consultant, and my goal is to raise the financial well-being of architects through effortless business growth. Each podcast episode features an expert or thought leader from the AEC industry who shares their journey, challenges, and advice. Now, let's dive into this episode and welcome our guest for an exclusive interview. So let's start at the beginning. I mean, it's extremely fascinating, that story of David and Goliath. I mean, yeah. I really commend you for it. And I obviously noticed that immediately when I found you on social media, I was like, wow, this man is going and really into a quite a tough industry. There is so much funding needed to do these projects, these experiments, and your, let's just say, either competitors or other people in the field are ginormous, Blue Origin, Icon. And so it's a great aspiration of a designer, entrepreneur, visionary. Tell me a little bit about yourself, therefore. I'm really interested in you first, and then we talk about the projects.
Okay. Well, if we have to start from the beginning, I was born in London. My parents are Irish. They immigrated to the United States when I was seven. My father joined the American military. Became a citizen. And then afterwards, he did a tour in Vietnam. We were moved to Germany. And I lived most of my life because of my Irish family, because born in England and then living in Germany until I was about 18. And then my father's final assignment with the American military was at the Pentagon. And I said to them, I can't live in the United States. I have to move to New York. Otherwise, I go back to Europe. So I've always had a kind of New York, sort of urban, European mindset.
I get that completely.
So now I'm back, and at the moment I'm back in New York, but in COVID, I've been spending a lot of time at a house and home in Ireland, where I've been spending a lot of time in COVID. Sort of, I thought of this home for the future, but it, turns out that it's actually a better location, not only for me to have lived in the wilds of the Atlantic Ocean, where the house is located on the west coast of Ireland, but also it was an easier commute to some of our clients that we are developing in both Europe and in the Middle East. So it was took the edge off of the commuting distance, was good because, you know, everybody was working remotely. So that's one of the things that pre-COVID we were used to already because of our relationship with NASA and our aerospace clients. Most of the work had been done, including the people in our office, most of the work had been done remotely. So we've been working like this for years prior to the lockdown and everybody working that way. So it's something that we're quite used to. And I think that's an interesting aspect of not only the work that people are finding themselves doing now, but it's definitely part of the communication of, you know, for people that are going to be one day, hopefully, in outer space. And the distance and communication issues are something that we have learned to cooperatively and collaboratively work around. So that's all exciting. So I think that, you know, technology can bring us closer together. It's an interesting thing. And I think obviously with space, it will be a global effort, you know, to realize humanity's aspiration. And I guess that's where, you know, where we come into it as, you know, I stayed in New York, I trained as an architect in New York, I worked as a more traditional architect, but when I was a student, some of the more inspirational mentors to me, my teachers, were a few eccentric individuals, and one of them was a gentleman named Michael Khalil. And Michael Khalil was an interior designer, rather, but working in this kind of architectural scale, who designed a conceptual habitation for the space station, a module, a residential module for the space station. And he did it in such an interesting way. I thought, wow, when I grow up, that's what I want to do, you know, because I've always, having been raised in the 1970s with, you know, pop figures like David Bowie and these sort of avant-garde figures, I've always, you know, my parents would have taken us to the launches of Apollo and different things in the early 1970s. So as a young child, it was the end of the golden age of Apollo. But it was also this aesthetic of space that I was raised in. So when I got to college and there were people designing space stations, I said, that's what I want to do when I grow up. And then subsequently I met and married my late wife, who passed in 2012, Yoshiko Sato. She was a native of Japan. And she also had a very keen interest in space and did her thesis on the moon. And when she was diagnosed with cancer in the mid-2000s, she decided that she wanted to live her dream and design for space. So she actually initiated quite a few people that are now rising in the space aeronautics space industry were our former students. She started a program of space architecture at Columbia University, where she was teaching, where she was the director of a second year in the graduate program. And she started her own space architecture program and laboratory. And then when she passed in 2012, I was invited to take over the course. And so it sort of initiated our almost 12, 15 years of research prior to winning the 2015 NASA Centennial Challenge competition with Mars Ice House, which I was the project leader of. And I brought in some of Yoshiko's former students, some of my former students, and we collaborated with another architectural office that was related, because one of them was my former student as well. So we were eight people working on that project. And then that established us in 2015 as the David firm against Goliaths. We beat Norman Foster, and we beat the European Space Agency in that competition to design a 3D printed habitat on Mars. Made in ice. So it was kind of all of our academic and, let's say, architectural avant-garde thinking and generating. We didn't, when we started the program in 2006, there wasn't really much interest in relative to architecture to space. I mean, there might have been a few people around the world, but it wasn't part of the, let's say, the cool people, the avant-garde people in architecture and design sort of thinking. It's actually, you know, come to that in the present day, but even in 2015, so we had to cultivate not only our own development and research, but we also had to cultivate a group of other people that would end up, you know, working with us and also maybe finding places in a burgeoning industry, that an expanding industry. And so, you know, I'm proud to say that not only as a designer, architect, I've moved into this space, but I've also quietly maybe cultivated quite a few other people who are, you know, taking prominent roles in the aerospace industry. So I'm proud of those two creative acts in both capacities.
Well, you know what, Michael? I mean, I just had this like incredible synchronicity and sort of realization moment as you were talking, because I heard about the Mars Ice House through Melody Yashar's presentation at one of conferences last year.
Yes.
We invited her because of her affiliation with Icon, and she actually showed your project there. I'm not sure exactly was the whether it was collaborative or she was showing other examples of what people do. But when you said that, I was like, wait a minute. Then I researched it really quickly in the background. And in fact, now I'm even more happy and honored to be talking to you.
Well, I know Melody. She was one of my former students. She is somebody that I gently brought into this. I don't think when she was an architecture student, I don't think she was explicitly interested in space architecture. When she took my course, I'm kind of an open-minded teacher. I created a space for her to feel comfortable. And she said, wow, I feel good doing this.
Yeah.
And then as when I finished teaching, when she graduated, I invited her expressively to come and participate on Mars Ice House. And admittedly, she had a little bit more of an observational role. She was kind of like thinking, you could see that she's thinking about whether she wants to go into this. And then, of course, I encouraged her to pursue her interest in robotics. She went to graduate school at Carnegie Mellon that I supported. And then, of course, when she came back, you know, we did projects together that I supported her interest. But you know, there were a lot of other collaborative designers involved in all of those projects. So since then, she moved on to Icon. We collaborated with Icon on a recent lunar project. And then as a result of that collaboration, Melody was offered a position and she took it.
So yeah, absolutely.
She left our little group and went into a bigger forum. But other former students have done the same. So it's a launching pad.
And
because I'm a part-time professor and I have an architectural practice as well as do space architecture, you know, I have a lot of different sources of income or opportunities of which, you know, a person that's being educated in this and wants to move into this has different opportunities, I think, as the aerospace industry expands. So,
you right. know, that's both, fascinating. I mean,
both,
it's really
both good and bad. You know, this is an opportunity that we've created opportunities for each other, or I should say, I have mentored these opportunities. And sometimes I think that the you know, as an older school person where as I started the conversation, my mentors and my teachers, I still talk about them with great honor and credit of inspiring me. Sometimes I wonder whether younger people do the same today.
Well, they should, because, you know, the thing is, what makes this very particularly unique and different is that, of course, as a scholar and, you know, you infuse these passions that very often will result in people actually choosing these pathways as their careers. But in this case, what makes it even more unique is that you're launching people into a really, really new industry, because space architecture, first and foremost, in fact, I think this was something we were discussing at the conference when Melody was speaking, that there is only one course in America that does space architecture at university, and that's the one that you're talking about, in which case,
it wasn't even my course. It's actually a course at the University of Houston. We had a course at Columbia that we started, and then I took that same course to Pratt and won various NASA grants to engage with students there. So I've won like 10 NASA grants to basically not only to in competition for design, but also in competition for academic programs. But there is one established space architecture program at the University of Houston. And funny enough, I was talking to somebody about that last night. They said, why don't you go down there and take over? And I was like, well, I have to live in Houston. I live in New York or
Europe.
Yeah,
I mean,
Houston is like a little bit like a strange.
Yeah, place. That would be a life quality country for sure.
I mean, I know Melody is living in Texas, but I'm like, I don't know. I don't know if I could live in Texas personally.
It's sometimes you compromise when you're early in your career, but I'm for you today, quality of life matters over, you know.
Well, New York is very New York is very limited also. So I see these opportunities. Like another person is working, Jeff Montes is a former student. He's working at Blue Origin. Mm-hmm. And Christina Ciardolo, she's doing her PhD on plant science and buildings at Yale. So a lot of my former associates and students are moving on and doing very interesting things. And ultimately, I'm very proud of them. But I,
absolutely.
You know, it sounds a little patronizing to use that term, but I'm very privately proud of them.
No, it makes sense. And actually, to finish the thought, like, I think that this, what makes this specifically unique is that it's not so common. There isn't many universities or courses right now that are preparing people for this profession. And yet this is the future. I mean, when we look at AI, you know, we already have a lot of robotic courses, you know, with IAC being completely dedicated to robotics and this type of technologies in Barcelona, all the way through to the AA that has technologies, courses as well, master courses and things like that, that are probably in Europe some of the strongest courses to take in robotics, but I'm sure in America as well. Yet robotics is not space architecture. Space architecture, in fact, has tremendous potential because it is the future. And to be fair, it takes many years to develop technologies that will be you know, inhabitable in space. So it's a matter of entering that field early and starting on these research and these technologies and these designs early, so that when we accomplish that and when the technology advances enough for us to be able to implement those technologies, we have enough experts that know what they're doing. Yeah. We have enough research to back up why we're doing that. And so that's why it matters. And I think what's really fascinating in your story is that you created this launch pact indeed. And, you know, of course you're proud and you should be, but also I think even beyond the different accomplishments of your students, just the fact that you're pioneering this topic in the world, because you are.
I would credit my late wife, Yoshiko Sato, Michael Khalil. I would credit my great mentor, Billy Tsien, who I just met last night, who's always an inspiration to me. I always have these really incredible people that are inspire you, and you say, wow, I want to live a life like they did creatively and go into space. And I also want to help other people as a teacher to also find their best thing. But I think the difference a little bit between a lot of these industries is that obviously they have to focus on a product and make money and generate and represent something. But as an architect, we're both winners and losers, because we think of things very holistically. Like, we have to think about the entire human being, the entire psychology, physiology, you know, community. We have to think about so many broad human issues as well as related to nature. And I think that is what fascinates me, is that, you know, as we think about potentially becoming post-human or even multi-planetary species.
Architecture Talk Tank is sponsored by the good people at Integrated Projects, a team of architects and technologists focused on the digitalization of the built environment. Did you know that there are more existing buildings in this world than websites? Yet only 0.0001% have been digitized. In response to this, the Integrated Projects team launched BIMIT to digitize any space imaginable. Offices, homes, mechanical spaces, you name it. Now any architect, engineers, or reality capture specialist can convert their 3D scan into LOD 200 BIM, just in hours, not weeks or months. Why does this matter? Well, now we can accurately view, verify, and quantify the spaces that we design, build, and operate. To learn more about BIMIT, visit www.integrated-projects.com/Sarah Collada.
You know, we have to think in ways that we have never thought before. So I think even the typical tracks of technology don't know this yet. you know, they're chipping away at something, but it's just the surface of the larger picture. And mm-hmm. I like to be in that space. It's why, you know, I love to work with NASA people, because you pinch yourself, you're like, wow, I'm in the room with rocket scientists.
Yeah.
They tell us all the time that the way we're trained as architects is we think very laterally. And they tell us all the time that you guys are at level zero. And it's like, whoa, that's very offensive. And they're like at level five or six in terms of their thinking.
Yeah, yeah.
But they say to us, the greatest thing that you guys do is, they don't say this in this way, but I always phrase it this way, that we ask really good, dumb questions.
Mm-hmm.
They're unable to go back to the origin of the problem in order to see it. Like they're in their own bubble. They're in their own level. And we're able to, as architects, because we think laterally, we're able to, you know, bring the problem basically back down to basics and build it up from there, mm-hmm. as opposed to starting with some adaption of existing technology. Yeah. So I think this is the kind of out of the box thinking that I have always been attracted to, whether it's on Earth or in space. It's just that on Earth, I was always feeling, even though I have received a lot of attention for my design work and building work, I always felt limited by not so much technology, but just by the calcified industry that one deals with and the problems and trying to solve things. And I obviously people have taken different tracks of building for, you know, humanity and relief, refugees, and this kind of very honorable thing, and have done it in incredibly inventive ways with local materials and inexpensive materials and safe materials. And I think this is also a very interesting track for innovative architects to work in. But I've, for some reason, the space thing was part of my youthful aesthetic and always a passion, and that's where I put my energy. I had never intended to specialize in something, so I kind of just, instead of being a career-minded person and directing towards a certain goal and focus, I've been more of a creative meandering person that found myself in this position just because it's the type of questions I like to ask myself and apply my thought process to, you know, these projects.
Sure, absolutely. And yet I'm sure that there is some type of strategy to be applied between an idea and working with NASA. So tell me a little bit about, you know, what gets you there, even though you describe yourself as a David in this big game, big player of space architecture, and you still work with the rocket scientists from NASA. Mm-hmm. How do you get into that room? Is it because of the academia? Is it because of research, or how did you get there? I mean, this is fascinating to me.
Well, there are only a few architects that I have met in the 20 something years I've been associated with NASA, in NASA, but they're oftentimes very frustrated because it's a more of an engineering mindset.
Sure.
And engineering used to be something that was very inventive, and not saying that NASA's engineers are not incredibly inventive. It's just that it tends to be a bit more problem solving.
Sure.
And I think that architects by nature are problematizers, like we create the questions rather than necessarily worry so much about the answer. We sort of have faith that the answer will come.
Yeah.
But we have to ask really good questions. So I think that when we first started taking groups of architecture students down to NASA, they were very, especially my late wife, who was Japanese, they were like, what's this Japanese woman doing in here with all these architecture students? And they don't really know about architecture because they had gotten so limited by, I think, the sort of thought process that was somewhat related to the ISS, the International Space Station, although that is an incredibly inventive architecture. I think that publicity-wise, people couldn't see that anymore as something inspirational. Like Apollo was very inspirational, but the International Space Station kind of looked very technical and uninteresting and uninspired ultimately, even though they tried to do live feeds. So they started to, somebody had a bright idea, I don't know who, to organize these competitions, and which we entered and won most of them for 3D printing habitats. I think we took, I don't know, like 7 first prizes out of 10 from these competitions, and both in terms of structural as well as design content. And so we would just ask, like, understand the technology, understand the question that's being asked, and sort of address it very specifically. But I think that the main inspiration we drew all the time, at least for me anyway, was talking to planetary, what I would call, they're not geologists, but planetary scientists who are studying the conditions on these planets, whether it be the Mars, the Moon, or an asteroid. And they would tell us something very interesting, like there's water on Mars, or there is a certain condition on the Moon. And I think as architects, that becomes something very conceptual, but it's also very physical, that is going to be required, that whatever we design helps human beings survive and ultimately thrive in those environments where that is the significant challenge, like radiation or so. And just talking to those people and having a conversation, well, if we made a house in ice, would that be good? That'd be brilliant. And so it just sparks a kind of thing. And once a NASA scientist says that to you as an architect, you're like, wow, I stumbled upon something that was a very innocent question, but it got such positive feedback that we said, well, this is what we have to go with, because we know, A, it's going to be very unique in relationship to our other competitors, and either we will use this and win it because of that, or we will fail brilliantly. So yeah. I think that's the kind of edge that you have to push your mind and your design ability to, is to the brink of failure or success. It's absolutely a kind of a adrenaline that you get as a designer. And I think because of that, going back to the nimbleness of being David versus Goliath, because of that nimbleness, we have a lot to lose. We have a lot to win. And so we can take those risks that I think that a corporate firm like Foster and Partners, or certainly an agency like the European Space Agency, cannot take that risk. Mm-hmm. And there are other players like SOM that are friends of ours. They're all individuals, or a couple of people, or people at Blue Origin, or people at SpaceX, or Melody at Icon. There are other people in this space, but they, once they move into a more corporatized product or image of a corporation, I think that their options potentially are more limited in terms of what kind of risks they can take, or what kind of images would be allowed, or what is the corporate, this is also going to be on the corporate website, so it has to fulfill a lot of other criteria, which we're not responsible for.
Sure.
We're responsible for our own dreams.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's really interesting because, you know, you're talking about this sort of idea of like the difference in thinking between engineers and people that are working for the space stations and people responsible for these experiments. And it makes a lot of sense because we are visionaries. We in fact get trained to be visionaries. And, you know, like, for example, obviously Disrupt is all about business, about entrepreneurship. And it's really interesting to me because I'm extremely fascinated in the idea of making your dreams come true and basically from big vision to execution. And that's what being an entrepreneur is, as well as being an architect. Mm. And sometimes as we cover a lot of topics of business, it's almost unbelievable to me that people can create a building from idea to realization, but cannot build a business from idea to realization, which is almost the same thing. It's systems, it's execution and perseverance, persistence. You do it eventually, and you don't always need to know what exact elements need to go in there, just like you don't know every single detail of how to build and how thick something needs to be or thin, or you know, drawing to execution. An architect doesn't need to possess all the knowledge to make it happen. We put together teams and we figure things out. And same in business. But when it comes to the topics that you're discussing, you know, I can see the value of having big visionaries together with detail-oriented people. Mm-hmm. And it sounds to me like NASA hires a lot of detail-oriented people because, yes, that's what's needed. That sort of expertise, that sort of detail approach to problem solving is needed to develop these technologies and do the relevant research and experiments. But in the same time, there is an absolute need for visionaries. And I love when you talked about the approaches, how when we come in as architects, we'll ask dumb questions that are good, right? Because putting it in a different context, but in fact, it's almost like a really crucial point as well to introduce into this process. So maybe following
that. People get so caught up in what they're doing that you sometimes when you ask them, why did you do that? They're like, I just got here. And I think that we're all aiming for the same thing. We're just approaching it in slightly different ways. I mean, I'm extremely detailed oriented person in terms of an architect. That's why I typically work in most of my clients here in New York are museum related, so I'm dealing with a lot of very valuable artwork. In space, it's the human being, and relative to NASA, that's the very valuable commodity. But it's the same kind of focus of detail that is required to conserve and preserve and allow these things to breathe in a way, whether they're an inanimate thing or an animate thing. So it requires a lot of patience and a lot of detail thinking. So I respect the detail thinking. It's just that sometimes the, you know, obviously budget and I'm also a realist as well. So, you know, I can work on both sides, but I like to be ideally in this position of being the protagonist and pushing the envelope is the space I'm obviously, as a creative person, I'm happiest. Yeah, but I think that, you know, businesses build up towards things and they develop a reputation. It's just that when you get there, because you've gone along a certain kind of pathway, did you get to the right place? I mean, I think that, you know, we see this in the history of construction industry, right? We see this, you know, when they develop something, become such a big business that it's difficult to undo this business in order to, you know, use a new material or reframe how it was done.
This episode of Architecture Talk Tank is brought to you by the MGS Global Group, a team that provides on-demand CAD and BIM drafting, as well as renderings for architecture firms. In today's environment, with everyone experiencing a surge in projects and staffing challenges, MGS Global can deliver your drawings on time and within your budget. So why work with MGS Global? Their customer service is exceptional and they provide quality for value. They have completed over 5,000 projects worldwide, a testament to their work. Now you can focus on design and let MGS do the rest. Check them out at www.mgsglobalgroup.com.
Yeah.
And sometimes when things are done for millions of years, like bricks and stuff, it's okay. That's that's a proven technology that sometimes doesn't need to be reinvented. But space requires that all of that stuff to be obviously re-looked at. And I think that even though there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of hype around this, there's we are also aware of the fatal flaws in our own work and in the work of others. But we don't call each other out. We say, that's not going to work, or we know that didn't work, but you know, that's okay. I think it's okay to be in that process of trial by error. You have to, you know, as long as nobody's hurt. And I think that we just need to, like with the publicity and kind of exposure, we just need to encourage more people to, ideally with larger bank accounts, to participate in supporting this research and development that may or may not have immediate commercial value. So it's a very difficult thing. I think that people see satellites and rockets and these things that have more direct commercial value as being the sort of places where they put their money. And construction and space design is a little bit perhaps less value because people don't see an immediate return on investment. So this takes a visionary benefactor or client to be able to understand. And I have met some really very visionary, very wealthy people who are doing things like building a friend and client, or not client, but friend and associate of mine is a French entrepreneur, and he's building a company to send plants into space so that they become altered DNA wise so they can come back to Earth and withstand the effects of global warming. But he's a .com, you know, Microsoft billionaire, and you know, so there are people in the space that are doing things, I think, for the right reasons, as well as people that perhaps maybe also purely interested in profit, you know, just extending their profit, interested in technology, but it's more of a profit driven kind of thing, as opposed to, you know, making things better for people everywhere on Earth and beyond.
And to talk a little bit about industry-wide sort of approach to space architecture, we know obviously that there is research done through all these big companies like Blue Origin, Icon, and then you're there, but you did mention that there are some people at SOM, but SOM doesn't do projects like this, do they?
They do. They have our friend Yorgi Petrov, who's an architect engineer at SOM, who went to MIT and did his architecture thesis in a space project, which, you know, probably in the 2000s. I don't really know how old Yorgi actually is, but he's at SOM, and they did a Moon Village project, and that I was recently. Two of our projects are on exhibit in Paris, and they had one of the SOM, his Yorgi's project, the Moon Village project. And they also had a couple of projects from Foster and partners as sort of space architecture. But it's strange because in Europe, there is a lot more interest in what it is that we're doing in the kind of cultural sense than I think in America. I don't see too many American museums because we've exhibited our work all around the world, but only recently, I think, one of our projects is going to be included in the Smithsonian Space Air and Space Museum. But I think that other cultural institutions in Japan, Asia, and other several places in Europe have been interested in, you know, presenting our work to the general public in a kind of cultural sense, not only in a scientific sense. So I think that there's a, I don't know, it just seems like I don't know where the American mindset is sometimes with relative to space, and funding and NASA. Clearly, the United States has a great history as being the innovators and you know, the Apollo and participation in the ISS, it seems like maybe more smaller countries or countries that are fascinated with technology are more nimble and more interested in this kind of future life and technology, and therefore express more cultural interest in what that means. And that's right. Kind of subject matter that we are not so much when we present our work, we would ideally like to present our work as human habitats, and we're thinking about human beings living in these spaces rather than them looking like some technology, model of technology presented, because I think that's also something that we struggle with, is like, how do we go to these planets and celebrate being on the planet rather than landing a habitat that looks like a rocket, you know, and having a kind of separation. So we tried to build with the indigenous materials of the planet, and we tried to respond to the conditions in the situation like we would on Earth if we built north or south. You would actually make a climate-related, ideally a climate-related building, and celebrate the climate as opposed to deny it. And so in space, that's harder, but I think that there's still things that you can do that would celebrate human existence on a distant planet. And also hopefully create better lives for people that have to live 100% of their lives indoors. I mean, a lot of these planets, like the moon, they don't think they can walk on, and Mars, they don't think they can go outside. So I think a lot of the sci-fi presentations where you see astronauts walking around, it turns out is not a recommended situation. So we learn these things, like, because we also get influenced by these images or projections, sci-fi projections, yeah, of films and science fiction. But we learn more as we learn more and more. It seems like that's less and less of a possibility unless they invent something that helps people walk around. In some sense, the way they describe the Apollo astronauts walking around on the moon, they don't know how. Like, in today's medical terms, they don't know how those people actually survived and lived into long human lives, lived into their 90s. They're kind of like saying, we're not going to let astronauts do that again, which is a sort of precautionary attitude towards, obviously, the preservation. So it's just fascinating that... We took a lot more risks as humans than we're willing to do now in the contemporary thing. I think that since NASA, also you see great shifts in NASA when the Challenger and those space vehicles blew up, and they lost a lot of confidence. So I think that was also the privatization of the space industry, and their technology, but let other companies take the risks associated with human lives. And NASA is such an honorable organization that they didn't want to solely be responsible for the technological disasters that caused, you know, the loss of life.
Absolutely.
And that's it's very interesting. It's like a kind of like deeply technological, but also deeply humanist perspectives.
Mm-hmm. So really, would it be fair to say that at this stage, one of the reasons why we don't have more architects going in this direction, more courses, and the industries has not responded almost, it feels like, to the level that it requires, mm-hmm, is because of the technology perhaps not being there yet. And so therefore potentially there is less opportunities for profitability in that area, because it's quite obvious that with a lack of courses or a relevant amount of courses in this area, mm-hmm, we don't prepare experts in that field per se. And, you know, obviously we're living in the times where there is already advancement in technology if it comes to AI and a lot of other things, right? But But, you know, when I started to interview people that that are doing space architecture, a lot of them speak to the fact that there is not many courses and not many experts going in that field from our industry. And that's really just, it's almost surprising. It was definitely surprising to find out. And so, you know, what do you think is the reason for that? And how do you think the trajectory of the industry is going to move forward in that respect? Is there interest out of that industry, or are we waiting on some type of technological advancement that will make this time arrive and say, oh, okay, we did manage to land something in space and it worked, and then out of a sudden the industry is going to be like, oh, there's opportunity, we need more designers, we need more experts in that field, and so it will develop itself accordingly.
Well, it's interesting that you say that, because when we won these NASA competitions, we'd obviously been working on it quietly for many, many years, at least a dozen, if not 15 years, actively researching and organizing these courses and you know, chipping away at little projects, whether they be theatrical or a thing. We were moving in the space thing. So when we won the competition, you know, peers of ours turned around and said, how did you know how to be here? And I said, we didn't know. It wasn't a careerist sort of strategy that allowed us to arrive at a place where we all of a sudden got a lot of international recognition. We just followed our creative instincts and ended up there. And I think that the difference between a kind of an industry that is training and developing a product and also training people to work in that industry is something that is already established. There isn't this kind of, as I was saying before, this sort of creative leaps that are required, or this kind of understanding of the technology, but also having a kind of a little bit of a distant view of it. Maybe it's a critical view of it, and being able to draw upon different things and pull things together in a critical way. And I think that that's, you know, sometimes education and formatting and industry is very like linear. And I think, again, going back to this sort of lateral kind of condition, that if you're lateral, you can sprout up anywhere. You have a larger terrain. And so you have to be more multiverse. You have to be more able to look at and think about different aspects, because at each point there might be an opportunity. Maybe that will come from thinking about how do we grow plants in space, or how do we, you know, shield from radiation, or how do we, you know, work with water, or, you know, these kind of things are more multifaceted. And when you get very specific, like printing concrete or thing, that becomes your general image or your material, and sometimes you can't move, you know, with a kind of nimbleness that you need to actually address or solve a problem, and you kind of get into one track. Although I do think it's important to continue to attack and try to develop, follow an intuition about a particular problem like that. I think it's too, for investors, there's too much, 25 years of development is too long for people to say, wow, you know, we used to think in medieval times, we used to think in generations would build a Gothic cathedral. Space architecture, you have to ascribe to, well, maybe this won't get built in my lifetime. Maybe my thoughts will not be realized. And I think that's very difficult for people, but it's also very difficult for investment industry that wants to see the return on investment much more quickly and a line of industry established. So it's a double edge that you need it, but you also need to somehow remain slightly distant and critical from it. Eventually, you're going to follow a path, and hopefully that will be successful and lead somewhere. And I understand and respect anybody who does that. It's just it's hard, because you know, I think that schools used to be a place where you created an open forum, and it was a creative environment, and there wasn't necessarily an objective skill set that needed to be taught and learned and then applied for employment, that you would teach these things, but there would be more of an open-mindedness so that people could find, you know, unique and individual trajectories. But as these things become more and more conformed or more and more linear, it's just a hard, you know, education, industry, return on investment, creativity, they're sometimes not in the same space. And that's part of the struggle of any architect, really, is how do I realize my dreams, you know, in an industry that's not necessarily interested in supporting you in that way. It's a miracle. I think it comes down to sometimes, I'm not a religious person, but I think I think when you see something amazing and somebody is successful, it's amazing. And you know, I applaud people who pursue things with a passion and a uniqueness, but that, you know, and I question things that sometimes get presented that way, which is really perhaps not as unique as it, and not as successful as it's marketed to be. But that's the world we live in, right? This interview, this universe is kind of like, okay, it all helps, but you know, there's a kind of fake it till you make it mentality sometimes, and that's maybe not the best thing, but it works for a lot of people to, you know, keep trying. But if they have the money, they can hopefully make it work quicker. Anyway, just going off topic a little bit, yes, I think it's a bit of a vicious circle of how institutions can be more in the sense of a liberal arts or just a creative arts thing. We've seen that since the 70s with the demise of art colleges. Like, there are not many artistic colleges. They were created in the 70s in sense to keep, particularly in England, there's quite a bit of research done on this, like people like David Bowie ended up in art college. So it was kind of arts college was a place for misfits.
Yeah.
And there's not really, we don't really have schools of misfits anymore. So disruption, the concept of disruption is a place where you can channel your misfit energy and find your place and contribution to society. Because I think even misfits wanna contribute to society in a meaningful way. But we don't have those art colleges that got heavily funded in places like England, and they used to exist more so in New York, are more skill oriented these days, and they're not really about asking people to be creative misfits.
That's right. Yeah, absolutely.
I'm privileged by having grown up in a generation of that still had art colleges where you were evaluated on, you know, how creatively out of the box you could think.
That's right.
And we had teachers like that. And I don't think that is that. So when I'm a teacher, I try to, again, going back to that idea, I try to create a forum where somebody who has a notion can come in and maybe find their way. You know, that I'm not telling them per se, go this way, but I'm creating a platform. And I think that space, because it was so new in an architecture school, particularly at Columbia, was like, oh, people could discover themselves. It gave them a certain sense of freedom that was not part of the general, you know, curriculum.
That's right.
Both as a problem and as an environment that the teacher, professor can create, it created an opportunity. So yes, a school would be great. I think you would have a lot more opportunities, but I keep knocking on the doors for institutions to invite me to have a little program inside of them. But so far, I haven't been, I guess I haven't been convincing enough.
Okay. Well, it was really wonderful chatting to you. Thank you so much for telling me a lot about this industry and about your passions and your life. And, you know, it's really fascinating listening to you, how much inspiration about topics of space inspiration came out of your relationship and, you know, that sort of, your relationship, your household with your wife. It's really wonderful that, like, that sort of, that ambition, that vision originated, between like four walls sort of a love relationship, of partnership, and then span into affecting and influencing an industry. And yeah, it's a really interesting topic, I think, for architecture specifically, a little bit shocking and underwhelming how very little education there is, because this is the future. And you know, I think that we can all appreciate and understand that a lot of these this type of experiments, this type of projects take time, and it's just a shame that there isn't more offices and designers working on these.
It's a shame, particularly relative to a lot of conversations about sustainability or climate crisis and change, because a lot of the questions we're asking in space are particularly reverse relevant to changing the way we behave or live or here on Earth. So, I mean, thinking about the Earth also as a spaceship, from even from Buckminster Fuller, looking at the historical suggestions that have been throughout the 20th century, nothing new. It's just how the conversation is framed, and like, what are the possibilities of, they call it spin-offs in NASA, like how can the product be a spin-off? It's also the sort of conceptual thinking, as you said, like, I think that a lot of problems could be solved with, like, not just looking at things in a one track way, but to have a broadened horizon in that sense. The most broad horizon you could possibly present with discipline. I mean, obviously space takes a lot of discipline. So yeah, it's a double edge.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Sarah, and I appreciate the work that you're doing.
Thank you.
Wonderful. I have been aware of some of your pieces, and I see them, and they come across really strong in all of the other kind of stuff that you kind of bypass, you swipe. Your stuff has a kind of level of gravity, and I congratulate you for that, because they're very well constructed pieces, and they invite you to read them, not only because you've been writing about a subject I'm interested in and some of the people that I know, but it's also, I think, your graciousness and your formatting really is powerful.
Thank you. It really means a lot to hear some feedback, because it's been really many years in the making. I only recently launched it under a magazine, but these articles that we have now on the website have been produced as we were organizing events as means to write for LinkedIn to attract people to the events. Mm-hmm. So I've been writing these articles for the last 3 years, and as means of rebranding, in the last 6 months, we landed a sponsorship with HP, and they paid for us to relaunch the magazine. So we hired a branding agency, and we used the writings that already were there, over 100 articles, just gave them an uplift graphically, but the words did not change, neither the images we published before with them. But the response from the community is tremendous. I mean, literally, you know, out of a sudden, people are like treating this as something that, you know, that like as a product is amazing. And it's already been there, and it's been there through my profile, through the work that we've been doing with the event. And so it really speaks also to how people perceive sometimes your work differently when it's branded correctly, and it's not being seen in the same way, but before. But But really, all these writings, I've never really heard a single commentary or compliment about. Only now, when we are reaching out under the magazine, and it's just really gratifying to notice that effort, because this work.
But your work has a critical and intellectual feeling about it, and that makes it. Gives it a kind of legitimacy. I think that people also, when they look at searches images, the images that we produce, they're like, why am I looking at this? And I'm they're thinking like, it's not sci-fi. There's actually a lot of thought behind it. And I said, well, it's people say, oh, you do such nice renderings. And I'm like, it has nothing to do with the renderings. It's because the renderings represent an enormous amount of thought.
Right.
And I think that's the gravity, like the way that your pieces grab you. And I always notice them when I come across them, and I'll pause because or I'll go back to finding them. And I think that that's really the staying power of any brand or any work, is that there is real consciousness behind what it is that you're doing, and there's a real purpose and a rigor to that. And that's what I think is.
And
I was excited when you contacted me, because I said, oh, I already know her work.
Yeah, amazing.
Architecture Talk Tank has its own frequency. We're not a regular podcast, but we are here for you, always. If you have a suggestion for a guest or have a story that others in this community can benefit from, please contact me via social media or email me directly at me@saracolara.com. To sign up for my newsletter, simply go to the website saracolara.com. I am on Instagram, YouTube, and LinkedIn. You can find me by typing my name, Sara Colada. Come say hi. I'm always excited when you reach out. Bye for now, and see you in the next episode.